Hello, and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 13th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, tracing a fear memory through the brain and then erasing it. New materials that heal themselves when exposed to sunlight. And some energy analysts suggest that the world's coal production is about to peak. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
One of the fundamental questions in neuroscience is how the brain encodes and stores memories. To simplify the problem, researchers have been looking for the traces of a very specific memory within the brains of mice, that is, a memory of fear. In a paper in this week's Science, Sheena Jocelyn and colleagues report that they have identified such a fear memory in mice and erased it. The findings may someday lead to improved therapies for people trying to conquer their fears, but that's still many years to come. I spoke with Jocelyn from her office at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto and began by asking her how her team identified the network of neurons involved in storing the fear memory.
Well, we built on a previous study that we had published 2 years ago now, showing that a portion of neurons in the lateral amygdala, which is a brain region that's really important for fear conditioning, we found that neurons that had high levels of this transcription factor, or this protein called CREB, were more likely to be activated when we encoded or tested for fear memory in mice. So we thought, well, maybe these neurons with high levels of Krebs are the ones that are actually storing the memory. So in this study, what we did is we went in and just killed those neurons with high levels of Krebs, and we saw that the memory, in fact, was basically erased. So we concluded from that these neurons with high levels of Krebs in the amygdala are indeed the ones that are storing the memory.
Now, the memory was erased. Is this all memory? This was a fear memory, right?
This is a fear memory, exactly. So we like to say that it's a fairly specific erasure. So the animals could still relearn another fear memory. So we think it's very specific for that type of fear memory that we train them on. So we paired a tone with a foot shock, and then when we later give them a tone, they show fearful responses. So very basic Pavlovian conditioning. So in this study, when we played the tone again, they showed no fear to that tone.
Could they relearn the tone-fear connection?
Exactly. They could. So it wasn't like we were wiping out the entire amygdala, which would mean that they couldn't relearn this tone-fear memory.
And what about memories that they had previous to this tone-fear memory connection?
Exactly. So if we took out, you know, a similar portion of cells for a memory that they had learned a long time ago before, they could still remember that. So it was really specific.
Okay. Literally, a fear was being removed. How much of the amygdala did you affect?
Right. So the exact portion, we don't have an exact handle on. We figure it's about between 10 and 20% of the neurons. That's our high level. So we only destroyed between 10 and 20%. And that's probably an overestimate of how many neurons we destroyed.
And you said these neurons with the increased amount of Krebs factor
exactly,
were more likely. How much more likely were they to be a part of the fear memory than not?
Right. So our previous studies suggest that they're about 3 times more likely, just in normal mice. 12 times less likely if we decrease Krebs function. So we can manipulate Krebs function using viral vectors in specific neurons. So we can infect a neuron and have it overexpress Krebs, or we can infect a neuron and have it disrupt Krebs function. So when we infected neurons and had it disrupt Krebs function, we found that they were now 12 times less likely than their neighbors, which have normal Krebs function, to be holding the memory.
So you could enhance the fear memory.
We can enhance a fear memory if we overexpress Krebs. So Krebs, we know, is involved, it's necessary for normal memory formation. Now, we and several other groups have also showed that if we increase Krebs levels, we can also enhance memory formation. So you can do that by using a transgenic mouse that overexpresses Krebs, or we do it by using a viral vector to overexpress Krebs in some cells. And that has been fairly robustly shown in flies and aplasia, in mice and rats, that will enhance memory.
Did you test then destroying the neurons in these enhanced memory mice?
Exactly. So in these enhanced memory mice, we could totally bring their memory back down to normal levels if we just delete these cells that have a lot of Krebs, that we've artificially increased Krebs levels in.
And so they wouldn't remember the tone plus electric shock stimulus?
Exactly. So they don't remember that because we train them using a very, very weak sort of training paradigm where normal mice don't really remember very much.
But you were trying to compensate for the fact that they already had enhanced memory anyway.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So in the controls in that group, because we test memory two times, we test memory before we kill and we test memory after we kill, you could argue that what we're doing in the test is we just play the tone. And maybe the animal learns on that first test, hey, the tone no longer predicts shock. So it would be like an extinction sort of trial. And then maybe on the second test, they wouldn't remember very well.
Killing the mice afterwards to look at their brains and what's going on inside.
Yeah.
And what in particular did you look for inside the brain when looking for this memory trace?
Yeah, so we looked for this activity marker called ARC. Now, ARC is an immediate early gene, and one of the really cool things about ARC is that under, you know, normal conditions, when a mouse is just roaming around its cage, has very, very low levels of ARC. But ARC RNA, we can start to see about 5 minutes following neural activity. And this is a type of neural activity that induces something like LTP or memory. And that is induced really quickly within about 5 minutes. And it stays in the nucleus, but then it gets rapidly taken out to dendrites. And dendrites are the contacts from neurons that other neurons contact onto. So they're the receiving end of the information. Now, some people think that ARC is localized to dendrites that were activated. And other people think that ARC is localized to dendrites that were not activated. This is a little bit of a controversy in the literature, and we have to still sort this out. But for the purposes of our study, it doesn't really matter. What we're really looking at is ARC in the nucleus? Yes, then that neuron was active 5 minutes ago. Is ARC not in the nucleus? No, then that neuron was not active 5 minutes ago. So it's a yes or no choice. So we can time, basically, which neurons were active when we play the fear stimulus. So when we play the tone, we can identify neurons that have ARC just in their nucleus and say, okay, these neurons and only these neurons were active right when the tone was coming on. So we surmise from that that these neurons are ones involved in storing the memory.
The idea being that ARC doesn't get translated out to the dendrites before the 5 minutes happen.
Exactly.
Okay. Is this the same mechanism that is in all mammalian brains? Is it conserved across mammals?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what we've done is we've, you know, deleted a few cells in the lateral amygdala and basically erased a fear memory in a mouse. So that's a very limited sort of conclusion that we can draw from this. Now, whether it works for other types of memory, say a hippocampal spatial memory or a memory in the cortex, or whether it would work in another type of mammal, say a human, we don't know. We can just say that, well, we're trying studies in other brain regions and other types of memory now in mice, and we're trying to see if this is a generalized sort of feature or if this is very specific to amygdala and fear memories.
So we're not even close to looking at people at this point.
Right.
All right. Sheena Jocelyn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheena Jocelyn of the University of Toronto and the Hospital for Sick Children is senior author of a paper on the selective erasure of a fear memory. This week, President Obama reversed many science policies of the Bush administration. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Obama signed an executive order lifting his predecessor's limits on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. The order did not lay out ethical guidelines regarding the source of the embryonic cells, whether cells could be obtained, for example, only from embryos that would be discarded at infertility clinics. The order allows 120 days for the development of such guidelines by the National Institutes of Health. At the same time, Obama issued a memorandum directing the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy to devise a strategy to restore scientific integrity in federal decision-making. This will include mechanisms for choosing science advisors, ensuring the integrity of the scientific process within agencies, and increasing transparency. Other reversals are happening as well. Outgoing presidents frequently issue regulations just before leaving office, so-called midnight regulations, and former President Bush was no exception. The Health and Human Services Department has proposed reversal of a December ruling by the Bush administration that protected healthcare workers who refused to provide services like contraception on moral grounds. Several Bush regulations related to the environment also appear to be on their way out. Most recently, Obama directed the Interior and Commerce Departments to re-examine a late 2008 rule on the Endangered Species Act. That rule allowed federal agencies to bypass scientific reviews by the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association on the effects of agency actions on endangered species.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. An hour of sunlight is all that's needed to heal a scratch. No, not in your skin, but in new self-healing materials called oxetane-substituted chitosan networks. In a paper in this week's Science, Merrick Urban and Biswajit Ghosh report the chemistry and properties of their new self-healing materials, which are activated by ultraviolet light. I spoke with Urban from his office at the University of Southern Mississippi.
We developed a polymeric material that is able to repair by itself by exposure to the sunlight. And in essence, you create a scratch, and that scratch will disappear upon exposure to the sun.
How is this self-healing material different from other self-healing materials, other than the ultraviolet exposure being that which causes it to self-heal?
Well, this unique system combines polyurethane chemistry, which is typically used in many commercial applications, with the natural materials like chitosan and also with highly strained rings like oxetane or oxytone and many others, which incorporated in minute amounts into the network provide those unique properties. In most of the methods that are being used for self-healing, which are not really commercially available, they are more proof of concept, involve encapsulation of catalyst or cross-linkers into the network, which is fairly elaborate and many times simply economically not feasible, or incorporation of hollow fibers in composites, and the hollow area is filled with the cross-linker, with the fiber breaks, things are leaking into the network, supposedly healing the network. So that particular system is unique in a sense that it is a thermosetting system that does not require any heating, any temperature, and requires just exposure to sunlight.
Chemically, what's going on that makes this material heal when it's exposed to sunlight or ultraviolet light?
Chemically, what happens when, let's say, material is being damaged, as a result of the damage, breakage of oxetane ring occurs, and that generates reactive sites. And when this damage is exposed to ultraviolet light, to the sunlight, generates conversion of polyurea to polyurethane within the network, and polyurea is part of the network of the polyurethanes, and ether linkages are being formed as a result of exposure of chitosan, and chitosan is one of those abundant proteins which come from the shell crab and shrimp and what have you. So the combination of these chemistries combined with polyurethane network created by reactions of HDI and PEG generates this type of behavior.
And if the material is scratched again in the same place?
Well, that's a very good question. In principle, it should not be able to heal. But again, this has to be done in exactly the same molecular area that was damaged before. So obviously this is one of the drawbacks of the system because it is one-time self-repairing process in exactly the same area. But what are the chances that in exactly the same area, small rug or some object is going to hit the object?
Okay, so how did you and your co-author, Biswajit Ghosh, come to choose those components in making these self-healing materials?
Well, we were looking for essentially modifying networks that would require relatively low energy of breakage. And four-member ring like oxetane is one of those rings that is highly strained and does not require much energy to break. So it's relatively unstable species in that sense. So that was the first choice. The second choice of chitosan was first, it was just simply derivative of chitin, and consequently natural product, and it is also able to generate reactive species upon exposure to ultraviolet light. So small amounts of those two things and attaching oxetane to chitosan and then taking this precursor and implanting this in polyurethane network was motivation behind. So essentially you choose materials based on their chemical properties and ability to generate desirable responses.
And how available or inexpensive are these component materials? And what about the cost involved in manufacturing?
Well, you know, we are not in the manufacturing business, so one would have to sit down and really do the math and calculate the exact cost of the production. But as I said earlier, modifications of that kind would require, really the main difference in terms of the cost of the existing material versus this would be essentially the synthesis of chitosan modified with oxetane. So the cost is not really that great. And again, quantities are relatively small.
And the materials are widely available?
Oh, yes. Materials are widely available. And another feature of this system is the fact that you can choose different molecular weights of chitosan. And this is really, there's plenty of that available.
Now, you said this was a thermosetting polymer. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
Any concerns about the recycling or reusing this? I understand these are typically one of the least recycled materials.
That is correct. And, well, that is a simply thermosetting system, but again, sustainability of that system is tremendous, and that's why urethanes are being used as high-performance applications. Nevertheless, that high-performance application essentially also has some limitations in terms of the longevity of the material. So providing that type of self-repairing property will also increase sustainability of the material.
And what's next then? Is it commercialization for you or?
Well, we still, you know, this is the proof of concept. And I mean, we already have a lot of data regarding other type of derivatives of oxetane, different type of rings that will become available. So one option is obviously commercialization and patents and so on and so forth, which are pending. But we still have to determine a number of things. For example, how mechanical properties will change of the entire network. So there's still work to do, but we are on the right track. And with the current chemistry, which is not really very complicated, it has tremendous potential for improving properties of materials, not only necessarily for transportation industries, but other type of industries, furniture or anything that requires high-performance coatings.
Merrick Urban, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Merrick Urban of the University of Southern Mississippi is senior author of a paper on materials that repair themselves when exposed to ultraviolet light. Also in this week's Science, less transparency and more wood. Kaitsun Wang and colleagues report in a paper their analysis of aerosol concentrations in the sky, gathered worldwide since 1973. The team found that skies over land have become less transparent, with one exception, Europe, which has brightened. The authors note that many types of aerosols contribute to the dimming skies, but that the largest documented changes in aerosols and their precursors are those from increased use of fossil fuels, in particular, sulfur dioxide. In a policy forum, Daniel Richter and colleagues explained that advanced wood combustion currently supplies heat, cooling, and power in communities across Europe, and that the facilities emit remarkably low quantities of air pollutants. The authors suggest rekindling the use of wood for energy in the United States, where some states are already promoting advanced wood combustion systems. In related news, coal production may be nearing its peak. According to the World Coal Institute, coal is the largest source of energy for the world's electricity, and at current production levels, there are proven reserves to last 133 years. But as Science News writer Dick Kerr reports, new analysis suggests that coal production may peak as early as 2020, raising questions about when alternatives to coal might become available and about how bad greenhouse warming might get from burning the remaining coal. Here's Dick Kerr.
There's a lot of new interest in trying to anticipate when the world might run short of coal. There's been a lot of attention given to when the oil might run out. But now some researchers are applying the same kind of techniques to coal assessment. And the new approach is a bit sobering. The early estimates coming out of this work suggest that the world might be running out sooner rather than later, sometime in this century rather than the next century or two. And that has experts on both sides of the question getting into the fray, let's say.
How are these estimates being made? Is it by drilling holes in the ground or some other approach?
Well, people have drilled the holes, and then the resource assessment people come in. And they look at, well, there's the coal in those seams underground, But how much of it can we actually get out? How much is going to be practical? How much is going to be worth the cost of extracting it? And those are the geologists, and they turn all that into an estimate of how much coal is still in the ground that people will eventually take out. The new approach doesn't go to that data. It goes to production data. How much coal has been produced in North America or China or Great Britain in the last couple hundred years? And they take that data and do a pretty simple plotting of this historical production. And then they draw a line through it and come up with how much coal is ever going to be produced from a particular region. For example, Great Britain, the world's leading energy producer in the 19th century. Production in Great Britain peaked, reached its highest level in 1913, and it's been going down ever since. And so these analysts look at that and come up with how much they're ever going to get out, and there isn't much time left for Great Britain coal production, they find. Then they can go using the same technique, look at other regions, North America, which is the Saudi Arabia of coal, or China or India, and take the same kind of data, but data from regions that haven't peaked yet. And the bottom line, depending on the analyst, is for coal to run out not in 150 or 200 years, but a few decades. One study finds that world coal production could peak by 2020 and struggle along for a few decades and then decline.
Where does this idea of using statistics, drawing the line from past production, come in estimating the amount of coal left?
It all goes back to a scientist, the late M. King Hubbert, who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey. And he came up with this method, which has been adopted with minor modification, for estimating when oil might start running short. He applied it to the U.S., and in 1956, he published his results. And at that time, he said it looked like U.S. oil production would peak in the early 1970s. Lo and behold, it peaked in 1970. And that has inspired a lot of people to apply the same technique to world oil. It hasn't been quite tested yet. It's rather controversial. But most of those so-called oil peakists have been calling for a peak in world oil production right about now or in the next 5 or 10 years. Well, the oil production has not been rising much lately. World oil production hasn't gone anywhere since 2005, despite the encouragement of high oil prices. And it's worked for a few oil regions, such as the North Sea, which peaked earlier this decade.
Now, you said that Great Britain and its production peaked at about the beginning of the 1900s. Is that because, in part, it was relying on coal, and as oil came into the fold, that they just said, well, we just don't need to produce it, it's not as economical to produce it, and that's why coal production went down?
Well, you're getting at probably the central contention in the debate. There's no doubt that coal production in Great Britain peaked. But why did it peak? Did they just run out of coal? There's just any left there? Well, that's not the case. There's coal in there. But they did find that other sources of energy were perhaps cheaper, more readily available, or just nicer to burn than coal. And that's when oil, natural gas from the North Sea for Great Britain started to replace, displace coal. The peakists might say, whatever the cause, it peaked, and we can tell you when it's going to peak. So they would call for redoubled efforts on coming up with alternative sources of energy, efficiency, or what have you.
Supposing we do burn all the world's coal, what's that do for climate change? What's that do for the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere?
Well, the thinking's been, or the assumption's been, that with all this coal, for example, around, and there is huge amounts of it, 4 trillion tons in the U.S. alone, with all this coal around, we're going to burn it and the CO2 will fill the atmosphere and scorch the Earth. Well, these new estimates suggest that it wouldn't be all that bad. Now, exactly how bad it might get, even with these, what you might call optimistic estimates, is still under consideration. But these estimates, while they might urge on the energy technologists looking for alternatives, you might see it as a comfort to climate modelers, and maybe the world wouldn't warm up so much. Tricky area to go. And certainly the climate people would like to have the answer sooner rather than later. So the coal peakists would like to get a more realistic picture of how bad things could get on the climate side.
Dick Kerr, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Rob.
Science news writer Dick Kerr reports on the analysis that suggests that coal production is nearing its peak. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David. What's new?
Hey, Rob. Well, I've got three very interesting stories for you. We've got a story on killer ozone, another one on monkey tantrums, and finally a story about a potential major flaw with futuristic eye scanners.
Killer ozone. Is this ozone like in the ozone layer?
Well, it's the same chemical, but the ozone in the ozone layer we often think of as protective. It protects us from the sun's UV rays. But the ozone we're talking about in this study has to do with ground-based ozone.
A pollutant.
It is a pollutant, and it's actually not what they call a primary pollutant. So your car, for example, doesn't emit ozone, but it emits other chemicals that react with sunlight to create ozone. So they call it a secondary pollutant. But it's a pollutant nonetheless, and researchers I've been trying to figure out how harmful is it to us? Is it as harmful as a lot of the other pollutants you would find in a major city?
So this is why they have those ozone alerts some days when they say, okay, everybody stop driving.
Exactly. And so there is the feeling that it is harmful. And in fact, some studies with lab animals have shown that it creates inflammation in the airways, and it can also lead to asthma and other lung problems. So it seems to be dangerous, but there really hasn't been a big comprehensive study to show what effect ozone really has on human health.
Until now.
So this study is really big. They actually tracked about 500,000 people. And these were actually people that were part of another study dealing with cancer prevention. So the ozone people just took this data, and these people lived in about 100 different U.S. cities. And some of these cities had really high ozone levels, like Riverside, California, and some had low ozone levels, like San Francisco. And what they found is that for every increase in ozone of 10 parts per billion in a city, the risk of death from some sort of lung problem increased 2.9%.
So how long did they follow this group of people, and how many people are we talking about then?
Well, Rob, they followed these people for about 18 years. And over that period, about 10,000 people died from respiratory causes. So they had a lot of good data. And what they found is if you compare those cities like Riverside with the high ozone and San Francisco with the low ozone, people were three times more likely to die from lung disease in Riverside than they were in San Francisco.
That sounds fairly significant, but we're still talking low numbers of people, right?
Overall, this is still a low number, and these are sort of modest increases for the amount of increase in ozone that you're seeing. So clearly, there's a lot of other factors that contribute to lung disease and, you know, lung and cardiovascular problems. But what this study is showing is that ozone truly is a risk factor and that it can cause these sorts of problems. And we just didn't really have this comprehensive data before.
So as you say, this is the first study, so we'll be looking for confirmatory studies to come.
Exactly. And the reason that's important is because if it turns out that ozone is this real problem, then the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. and other regulatory agencies around the world would ostensibly want to try to find a way to limit ozone levels in cities to protect the populations.
Okay, so next to monkey tantrums. What kind of monkeys and why are they throwing tantrums?
Well, Rob, this has to deal with rhesus macaques. And any parent who's had a young child in a grocery store knows that it can be really embarrassing if your kid, say, wants a piece of candy and you say, I'm not going to buy that for you. And they start flailing their arms and screaming and spinning around on the floor. And you've got all these people standing around you and It's just embarrassing. It's a bad scene for everyone.
So we're talking about young monkeys, too.
Well, we're talking about young monkeys, and it turns out this scene actually plays out in monkey societies when a young monkey, say, wants to nurse, and his mother is ignoring him. He can throw a tantrum very similar to what a human child might throw. And it's actually really annoying to listen to. Here's just a clip of a young macaque throwing a tantrum.
Oh, yeah.
And you can actually see a video of this on the site as well. It's pretty impressive.
That's really annoying. So how do the mothers react to that?
Well, it actually turns out that a lot of the time they just ignore their kids. In fact, in this new study, the researchers followed a group of monkeys that live on an island off the coast of Puerto Rico. And I think they followed about 11 females and their kids and a lot of the other monkeys in the community. And what they saw was that when these young monkeys started throwing tantrums, about 40 to 50% of the time, the mothers wouldn't do anything. And this was usually in cases when their mother was alone and the young monkey started throwing a tantrum, or when the mother was maybe surrounded by some close relatives. So almost half the time, the mother's really ignoring that.
So what happens in society? Might give in a little easier? Is that the idea?
Well, it's kind of the idea, though. It's a much more dramatic example. Imagine your kid is having a tantrum in the grocery store, and everybody around you starts beating you up.
No.
That's essentially what happens here when a mother is with her young one. The young one starts throwing a tantrum, and she's surrounded by other monkeys who aren't close relatives and who are usually higher in the pecking order than she is. All of a sudden, these monkeys will start attacking the mother, attacking the child, biting them, scratching them, pushing and pulling them.
The child, too.
The child, too. And so what the researchers found is that sort of as a preemptive, as a way to avoid this, when the mother is around these individuals and her baby starts throwing a tantrum, she's much more likely. In fact, she's about 80% likely to quiet the child down, to start nursing the child, to do anything she can to prevent the young monkey from throwing a tantrum.
And so keeping from being kicked and scratched and things like that.
Exactly.
Do the researchers have any idea why the other monkeys would be violent towards the mother and the child?
Well, you know, in studies like this, we like to say that maybe there's an evolutionary reason. Maybe, you know, that the monkeys just are trying to protect themselves from predators and they don't want loud noises. But in fact, the researcher says in this case, maybe the other monkeys just find the sound really annoying. And you might too. Listen again.
Yeah, although if I heard that in a grocery store, I'd be a little worried. So last then, eye scanning. I remember seeing this in some movie a couple of years ago. Minority Report, was that it?
Right. That was the one with Tom Cruise. And actually, it's been in a lot of, you know, so-called futuristic movies where someone will maybe go up to the door of a secure compound and all of a sudden a red beam will flash onto their eyes and scan their retina and then they'll be granted access or maybe denied access to the compound.
There was even a James Bond movie about this.
Exactly. And it turns out this technology is actually really not that futuristic. There are a number of airports that are actually employing it now, and it's becoming more popular as a way to really recognize people and for security applications. And what researchers say is it's actually a lot more accurate than, say, fingerprinting, and obviously a lot more immediate. Fingerprinting has an error rate of about 1 in 100,000, and this eye scanning has an error rate of only about 1 in a million.
1 in a million still seems like a pretty big number, given all the people that travel.
That's true, but it's really the best technology we would have right now. But you raise a good point that there are limits to this technology. And one of the big limits that researchers have been worried about is, what if there's something wrong with your eye? What if you have an eye infection or you even have like an eye disease like glaucoma or cataracts? Since this technology is so dependent on what your eye looks like, will somebody who develops this disease all of a sudden not be recognizable by these eye scanners?
Well, how does this exactly work? You said it scans your eye. How much of a match does it need with what it's got stored before it says, you are you?
Well, this is how it works. It scans your whole eye, eyelashes and all, but then it erases everything except for your iris. And this is the colored part of your eye around your pupil. And it turns this image of your iris into a numerical code. And then it stores this code so that when you come back to the machine again, it scans your eye, takes your iris code, and compares it to what it has on file. And as long as there's a pretty good match, it doesn't actually have to be 100% match. And it actually can rarely be 100% match because changes in lighting or changes in your pupil dilation can change the way your iris looks. But as long as there's a pretty good match, the system will recognize you. But that's the concern with these diseases, because these diseases can change the way your iris looks potentially. So are they going to muck up this technology?
Do all eye diseases affect the ability of this system?
Well, no. It turns out that researchers only found one condition that seems to be problematic, and this is a condition called iritis, which causes an inflammation of the iris that actually distorts what the iris looks like. And you can see a pretty interesting picture of this on the site. And the researchers found that when patients had iritis and then they got scanned and they had their iritis cured, so their irises returned to normal, the machines didn't recognize them anymore. And what was surprising is a lot of other eye problems, like we mentioned, like conjunctivitis or glaucoma, didn't affect the machine's ability to read eyes. It was just iritis.
How often does iritis occur in people?
Well, that's the problem. It has an incidence rate of about 1 in 1,000. So it's actually not that rare. And you can imagine if with that many people, and as you said, with so many people going through, say, airports or border crossings or whatever, it could potentially be a real problem for these systems.
So 1 in 1 million accuracy rate by these eye scanners, 1 in 1,000 chance of a person having iritis. It sounds like fingerprints may not be so bad after all as identification.
Well, right. And it's not perfect. And obviously, researchers are going to keep on working to optimize these systems. But it's always important to have a backup.
Yeah, I still carry around my ID.
There you go.
Okay. So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now? We're on the policy blog, Science Insider.
Well, Rob, on Science Now, we're looking into a new super battery and another item about how memories are formed. And for the Science Policy blog, our science policy guru here, Eli Kintish, is actually in Copenhagen at an international climate conference. And this is a bunch of scientists and politicians getting together to try to come up with a policy for how individual nations can tackle climate change. So be sure to check that out on the site.
David, thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link for the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the March 13th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks again to those of you who wrote or filled out our online anonymous survey. Changes are to come. At any time, if you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.